Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and this is special coverage of the events that have followed the death of Justine Ruscek. Here's some context that may be valuable for the hour ahead. Ms. Ruscek was killed by Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor last Saturday night as she stood next to a patrol car. She'd alerted 911 to what she thought was a sexual assault in the alley behind her house. The police officer's body cameras were not turned on. There appears to be no video of the shooting. Officer Noor has not yet spoken to investigators, as far as we know. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto returns from a vacation and tells the media,
"Justine didn't have to die. Based on the publicly released information from the BCA, this should not have happened. On our squad cars, you will find the words, 'To protect with courage and serve with compassion.' This did not happen. Having the information that is publicly available right now, while recognizing there is an open BCA investigation, I believe the actions in question go against who we are as a department, how we train, and the expectations we have for our officers."
By Friday, Chief Harto is out, and Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges has appointed an interim chief. But Mayor Hodges is also confronting protests over her own leadership.
"We do not want you as the mayor of Minneapolis, and we're asking you to resign.
Today, we'll talk about what happens next, how and whether this shooting fits into a national pattern of police shootings. And your voice is really important in this discussion as well. Are you giving some thought to what the Clark shooting, the Castile shooting, and now the Ruscek shooting says about who we are as Minnesotans? Are we getting the leadership we need to discuss and debate and confront that question? So I'd like you to think about this in a larger picture. Give some thought to what this pattern of police shootings in our area and beyond says about who we are as Minnesotans and perhaps as Americans. Are we getting the leadership we need to discuss and debate and confront that question? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can reach me on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. We're beginning this hour with Lene Palmisano. She's a member of the Minneapolis City Council. She represents the 13th ward in which Ms. Ruscek lived, and she joins me in the studio. And welcome. It's good to have you here.
Good afternoon.
We're also hearing Brant Williams. He's a reporter for NPR, and he's been covering the story. And Brant, welcome. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Carrie.
Is there anything new in the investigation since this morning?
Not since this morning, but just to make sure people are clear, the BCA did state that they have a witness who was at the scene directly after the shooting, appeared to have witnessed the officers administering CPR to Justine Ruscek after the shooting. We don't know anything else as far as what that person saw, whether they were there at the time of the shooting. Those are details that will have to come out when the investigation is finished.
I said that there appears to be no video. Has the BCA said, because the body cams weren't turned on and because the squad car camera wasn't turned on, has the BCA clarified whether maybe this witness that they've just talked about has some kind of video of it?
They did not clarify that. We don't know if that person was sitting there with a phone shooting video of that incident. We just know they said that this person witnessed the events immediately following the shooting.
Ms. Palmisano, did you concur with Mayor Hodges that Chief Harto had to go? Did you agree with that decision?
I did. On Friday morning, I called for leadership change in our police department. People hadn't really been talking about it in City Hall until Friday morning.
Why
after
not?
That council meeting.
Why not, do you think?
Perhaps because of all of the events around that week. I mean, things were just moving so fast with this latest officer-involved shooting and everything. To my knowledge, there were not conversations about it until Friday morning.
And did you believe that Chief Harto had to resign because there is some connection in the way this shooting occurred and in her leadership of the people that she supervises? I mean, what is the connection between what happened and the way Chief Harto manages the department?
That's a good question, Carrie. I think that this is more about, this has been a long process. And in all of these situations end up being cumulative. People feel stronger and stronger about the need for police reform, mm-hmm. For police reform from top to bottom. Janae Harto has served our city very well in the past as our police chief. She's implemented some really progressive policing 2.0 kinds of initiatives. But there's been a growing sense, especially from a lot of outcry this past week. Myself, it's my constituent and from my constituency that live in this neighborhood and in this area, that the time has come for change.
I guess I'm trying to understand whether it is, well, the buck has to stop with someone because we're not happy with what appears to be a series of shootings and perhaps a pattern. And the person at the top, that's where the buck stops, and somebody has to, what, take the fall for this, hold responsibility for it. Mm-hmm. Or is it a feeling that specifically there were things that she was not doing that have led to actions by police officers for which she has to be accountable?
I think I've heard both this week coming from the public.
What's the police union saying about this, Bran? I know you've talked to them.
Yeah, I talked to Lieutenant Bob Kroll, the president of the Minneapolis Police Union, yesterday, and he told me that he couldn't say more about the shooting itself. He said he has been in contact with Officer Noor just as a check-in to see how things are going. As far as Bob Kroll knew, Noor had not spoken with investigators at the BCA yet, but who knows? We don't know right now if that has happened since then. But Kroll said, you know, his feeling is that, number one, he has not come out and said anything about this incident because Noor has not spoken to the investigators. And then usually what happens is after an officer-involved shooting, the officer will have an attorney with them during the briefing with the BCA or whoever's mm-hmm. investigating. Mm-hmm. Then the union is in contact with that lawyer. And so after the Jamar Clark shooting, when we heard Bob Kroll say that Jamar Clark had reached for an officer's gun, that was because that officer had told that attorney had told the union about what the officer told them.
I see.
So that's why there's some silence. And of course, there's other reasons why that may be. People are speculating that there's a double standard out there. But that's something else that we can talk about at length.
And the police union on the resignation of Chief Harto.
Kroll was supportive of Arredondo being named as the interim chief.
Does that mean they actively wanted Harto out?
You know, I did not get that sense. I'm sure he's had a favorable. He said he's had a good working relationship with Harto in the past. Mm-hmm. And I actually can't recall if he'd mentioned that he felt like she should have gone. I would not be surprised if he said yes. That's the action that had to be taken.
Lene Pomposano, you mentioned leadership, and I thought we could take a couple calls on that since
sure.
we're asking mm-hmm. Minnesotans what they think about this. To Ty in Edina. Ty, you want to talk about leadership? What are you thinking about?
Well, some of my thoughts are that part of the issues are that we're having with police brutality, police on civilian violence, is because of the leadership. I believe that it starts at the top. We have not only a leadership, but even a society. And as more accepting as we see these shootings and as common as these shootings have become, it was only a matter of time before it spilled from the minority community and over into the greater community from there. And it's just continued to grow and become an issue. I think it's something that as a community within Minnesota, within our country, as society, that we really, really need to take a look at and see why is this okay on any level.
Thanks very much, Ty. Do you believe, Lene Pomposano, that leadership that Ty and others seem to be concerned about kind of begins and ends at the top of the police department, or are we talking about city leadership as a whole? Because then that could extend to Mayor Hodges.
I do agree that it is leadership as a whole. from the aspect that the mayor appoints the police chief and it's confirmed by council through a public process. I really connect with what the caller said, that the leadership starts at the top. You know, something that I've been trying to work on for my whole first term in office so far has been about body camera work. Mm-hmm. And some of that work that it's very apparent need be done is something that the chief of police can do, and that's on standard operating protocol and maybe putting new rules in place. But in terms of the sentiment that was coming from the man on the phone, it's really about what's the culture like? Are officers, what behaviorally can inspire people to want to have these cameras more on at all times? And that might not be a hard and fast standard operating procedure, mm-hmm. but more the culture from the top.
And do you believe that the culture is most influenced by the person at the top of the police department? Or, I mean, does some of that responsibility and accountability fall at the city council's feet and at the mayor's feet? Are you responsible, do you think, in some ways for the culture within the department as well?
I do think that we can do things to help affect that culture. Right now, the way our police chief is set up to report to the mayor and police largely to the mayor, city council's role is more of a funding opportunity.
Do you think that should change with the new chief?
I'm open to exploring it. I asked for change from top to bottom. And yes, there's leadership change needed at the top. That happened really quickly here on Friday. But how do we look at all of the different elements from top to bottom?
Can I ask you, given that you just said it happened really quickly, did it happen too quickly to have some serious consideration of what is needed within the department, and particularly what you've just said about the reporting hierarchy?
Mm-hmm. I owe it to my constituents to be very considerate about this next step. I think everybody does on city council and the mayor's office. And I think the worst that we could do in this situation is to be reactionary. I'm very complimentary of Rondo, his role in working with city council, the public.
This is Madeira Arredondo, who is the interim chief.
Correct.
Yes.
We affectionately refer to him as Rondo. Rondo was the public facing rollout of the police anti-bias training in my ward at a big community event. But perhaps we could look at other cities. We could look at both internal and external candidates, and we at least owe it to the public to have a lot of input on this as it moves forward.
Brant, what's your sense about what this search will entail?
Well, for now, it sounds like, as Councilmember Palmisano mentioned, that Arredondo does have a lot of support on the city council. Folks generally like him. And it could be a matter of whoever is the next mayor, if it's not Hodges, may be looking at ahead to somebody else, and they may look outside the city. Now, we did have an outside police chief who came in the early 2000s, Bill McManus, who was very popular in the community, a lot of the folk community activists who worked with the police department on trying to improve community relations were very happy with him, mm-hmm. but he did not have the best relationship with his mayor, R.T. Ryback, at the time. And so that all just stresses the mayors have to have somebody that they have confidence in and they feel good working with in order to have that good bond that will make that relationship successful.
This is something we're going to talk about a bit later in the hour, but the average, do you have a sense about what the average tenure is for a big city police chief?
For a big city police
yeah.
chief? I don't.
It's 2.5 years.
Wow.
So Chief Harto, her tenure extended beyond that, mm-hmm. but it gives you a sense of what these chiefs confront.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, they say, well, there are a lot of semantics around as well as is Arredondo an interim or is he a real, aren't we all interim here? You know, we're all interim here.
Well, but do you want the chief to think of it that way as I'm just?
No, but I do want the chief to feel accountable to the people that they're there to serve in every way. And some of that is through the mayor's office and some of that is through city council. And a lot of it is to the community.
Let me take one last call for you to Terrence in St. Paul. Hi, Terrence. Thanks very much for
Hi,
waiting.
Thanks,
appreciate
sir.
It. Hi, go ahead.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The comment I wanted to make is one that comes up between my friends and I pretty frequently. I think police institutionally are looked at as heroes in our society. I think the one reason we can say that is that they're heroes because they put their lives on the line every day, right? They risk their lives for our safety. Mm-hmm. And as a citizen in a city where there's been some shootings, justified or not, to keep hearing the excuse that they fear for their lives as a way to legitimize shooting somebody, it falls flat with me. The whole point to their job is that they do the dangerous things. They do the risky things. They do risk their lives. And it just doesn't jive with me that that can be an acceptable excuse for somebody in that line of duty for making the wrong decision.
Terrence, I really hope you can stay with us as the conversation continues this hour, because we're going to get right to what you've just said. But I'm going to ask Linnea Palmisano for a thought on that. Linnea?
I appreciate that. It reminds me that one of the pieces of feedback I heard from a constituent this past week was how we reevaluate the use of force, and could we require supervisor notification for drawing or pointing a gun at someone? Would that help officers start to see how quickly something can escalate, or give a supervisor an opportunity for coaching and for knowing that there's an officer on the street that maybe is fearing for their lives in a real way, in a way that is about their mental health and well-being?
So notification after an incident has occurred,
and
the supervisor would be notified that had happened to one of the officers.
This particular idea was any time our officer pulls out a gun on somebody, which currently doesn't require notification. It would be like a hold or a takedown move, doesn't require a Keppers report or supervisor notification. But
so a supervisor might understand more about the state of mind that an officer is in an ongoing way.
If you see them continually pulling out their weapon to handle situations, then that could be indicative of some other kind of problem that they're feeling, or some stress that they feel under.
Thank you very much for joining us today in the studio.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Brant, thank you for
You're welcome.
The reporting over the weekend and today, too.
It's my pleasure.
You're listening to a special NPR News Presents call-in program today. And we are, of course, taking note of the events that have followed the death of Justine Ruschek at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer, the changes that occurred at the top of the police department, some of the insight that members of the city council have been giving us on this, some of the things that Mayor Hodges has said about it. And I'm asking you to think about this, perhaps if you take a bit of a step back and think of this in a more, I don't know, philosophical or through the lens of identity as neighbors, as community members, are you giving some thought to what the Clark shooting, the Castile shooting, and now the Ruschek shooting says about who we are as Minnesotans, who we are as neighbors, as members of the community? And are we getting the kind of leadership that we need to discuss and debate that question? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Turning now to Susan Gertner. She's former Ramsey County attorney and now a principal at Gray Plant Moody. Susan, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Well, thanks. Although I must say I'm on your show way too much, Carrie, talking about shootings like this.
I have to agree, that's true. We're asking you if you would give us some insight into what County Attorney Mike Freeman might have to consider in a case like this, where he would have to think about whether to charge, particularly given the fact, Susan, that there is apparently no video, no body cam or squad car video. So what kinds of standards would a county attorney be looking at with the details that are evolving the way they are?
Well, the standards would be the same, whether or not there had been a dash cam video or whether or not there had been body cams that had been turned on. The standard is whether or not there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime was committed. And obviously, one of the barriers that might be in place when County Attorney Freeman considers this, if the case is brought to him, is how much evidence there is or isn't. In other words, it's a easier decision one way or the other if you have more facts. And I had said back at the time of the Castile shooting that one of the reasons that it might explain why that case was charged and many others before it were not, mm-hmm, was the presence of the dash cam video. I mean, that gives a prosecutor an opportunity to put together a case, an opportunity to try to figure out what happened here and is what happened a crime.
Isn't there also, though, an acknowledgement that, and actually I think Mike Freeman said this at one point, that video is not always kind of the end-all be-all for a prosecutor and for public opinion, by the way. Because
no question about that, that the public expectation, that jurors' expectations, the media's expectation that a video is going to be conclusive one way or the other, those expectations are rarely, if ever, met. That is for sure. But at least it is additional data that can be used to provide an explanation. Either way.
Presuming that Officer Noor, who, as Brandt noted, has not yet given a statement apparently to investigators, presuming that he will before the county attorney has to charge, how important would that statement be in that decision?
Well, that statement, of course, would be very critical to the decision. You'd need to take a look at what information is provided, what is the story, how is the perspective of the officer who did the shooting, Officer Moore, what were his perceptions, why did he do what he did? Because, of course, what the dynamic in all these cases is that the law is very protective of police officers in making these life and death decisions, whether or not to use deadly force.
And Susan, I just want to, you used that word protective. Tell me what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is right from the United States Supreme Court, we get case law that says that in evaluating after the fact a decision that was made by an officer to use deadly force, we cannot use the whole 2020 vision in hindsight kind of standard. In other words, the standard is not should the officer have pulled the trigger, was the officer really in danger, or was other individuals in the area in danger, did that deadly force need to be used. That's not the standard. Mm-hmm. According to the United States Supreme Court, it is, was that officer's decision reasonable based on what that officer perceived and what their feeling of risk was. In other words, it's not in many ways a reasonable person standard. It's not what you and I would have done in that situation. It's more, you know, the officer has a right to use deadly force when he or she feels threatened.
I think this is really important. Do you think this is well understood?
I absolutely do not think it's well understood. And I think oftentimes in these discussions over the last couple of years when we've had these shootings, I've heard a lot of people say, well, let's change the law. Let's change the law. And, you know, maybe talking to their legislators, for that matter, about fixing this perceived issue that officers have too much leeway in these kinds of cases. And what I don't think is understood is that this is coming from the United States Supreme Court.
So this is my question about frame of mind then, and it kind of goes to what you've just said. Mike Freeman is going to be making a charging decision in a highly sensitive atmosphere. And he's going to be making it about an officer who was working in a highly charged atmosphere with what's been happening with police officers, the cases that we've had in the area, some of the ambushes of police officers in other cities. Is it the job of the county attorney to push all of that aside, or is it the job of the county attorney to acknowledge that and think about what that means in a charging decision? Does that make sense?
Well, it is the county attorney's responsibility to take into account the reality of being on the street and being a police officer and making life or death decisions in the blink of an eye. That is part of the equation, needs to be part of the equation in evaluating whether or not again, you have a crime, not whether or not it was a good decision to shoot, but was it a crime? Was it an act eminently dangerous to others, as the murder third degree requires? Is it a culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk? Those legal terms, you need to prove those things if you're going to charge someone. And so all the circumstances surrounding the shooting itself are going to be part of that equation. The point about the law being protective of officers is that, again, officers are given fairly wide latitude in evaluating after the fact the decision to shoot. And, again, everyone wants the law changed, et cetera, but do they really? Do we really want to change the law to remove those protections for police officers and then expect to have them go out on the street and protect us?
Susan, it's always instructive. Thank you very much for the time and the insight. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Take care.
Susan Gertner is a principal at Gray Plant Moody and a former Ramsey County attorney. You're listening to special coverage this morning at NPR News Presents about the events that have followed the death of Justine Ruschek. We've heard from a former county attorney. We've heard from a member of the Minneapolis City Council. We heard from our journalist, Brant Williams, who's been covering the case. We're going to talk in just a moment with a couple of policing experts. But I also want to hear what you have to say, some of the questions that come up for you. And this question that I'm asking about what this means to a community like ours. This shooting, the Clark shooting, the Castile shooting, some of what's going on beyond the borders of our community. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. To Luke in Northeast Minneapolis. Hi, Luke.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. I want to know what you're thinking about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking a lot of things. The conversation is great, and I'm glad we're talking about it. But an earlier caller brought up something that I thought was perfect, which was the ability to make a judgment based on a perceived danger of life-threatening situation.
Right.
And the last woman who was on your panel, I was very intrigued by what she said, which was, if you change the law, do you expect the cops to still come out and do their job appropriately and be able to protect you in a situation where they feel like they can't protect themselves? I believe is what she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that we could find a better balance where it can't just be that there maybe is too much latitude in their ability to make that discretion. And maybe there should be higher pay and more training for cops, and then also more stringent rules on when they can claim perceived danger. So, for example, why can't it be that instead of them thinking that they had a gun, they have to actually see a weapon? And I think one of the problems, too, is that part of the discussion is that we're talking about people's lives. And when you restrict cops' ability to make that discretion, you may have more cop fatalities. But I'm wondering how many accidental shootings will be reduced compared to how many injuries on cops. And somehow we would actually have to have some kind of conversation about actual injuries that happen.
Okay. You've raised a good question, and I did want to pursue what our earlier caller talked about with this perception of fear. This gets to some of what I was asking Susan Gertner about. So let's bring in our other two guests. Dr. Chinger Charles is with us. She's executive director of the Institute for Spirituality and Policing and a professor at Saybrook University with us from Stockton, California. Ginger, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Jim Bierman is the president of the Police Foundation. It's a nonprofit dedicated to innovation and improvement in policing. And he spent quite a long time as a police officer in the Redlands, California Police Department. And Jim, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So Jim, I want to ask you about this thing that we've been getting to, and our callers are thinking about this as well, about the kind of atmosphere that policing is being done in now, and this sense of danger and sense of fear that officers may be going out on the streets, on their patrols, to their work, feeling, and whether that is more emphasized today because of some of what is going on, and how that influences behavior. Have you given some thought to that?
I have, and I've spent a lot of time talking to street cops about this, too, and, you know, based on my own experience, I think I understand this fairly well. But one of the things that we should I think, remember is that police officers are human beings that use social media, the internet. They have smartphones, mobile devices, like everybody else. So they consume information and news reports about officers being assaulted almost in real time. Mm-hmm. So just as your listeners and you and I will consume news about this shooting and we hear it a certain way, when there is an officer ambushed, like happened in Dallas or has happened now a couple of times in New York City or in Baton Rouge, police officers consume that information differently. There are social media sites that are specific to police officers so that they'll visit those frequently. And there is a constant messaging that begins in policing. It begins when you start. In fact, it probably begins even before you start during the interview process when they ask you about whether you could take somebody's life. And that messaging is that the job is dangerous and that cops get killed. You might be one of them if you're not careful. And you're training through the academy, you're training in your field officer training. In briefings, you may remember the scene that was at the beginning of every episode of Hill Street Blues where that grizzled old sergeant says, "Be careful out there now," or something to that effect. Cops are constantly sent these subliminal messages about how dangerous the job is. And in fact, it is dangerous. There are other occupations where statistically it's more dangerous. The difference between those and policing is when you are hurt or injured on the job in policing, about half of the time it's because another human being has injured or attempted to hurt you or kill you. And those things make it their personal safety, I think, very acute. I don't think we understand this enough. We don't understand the power of social media and the internet on how officers perceive their own safety. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing your other caller, Dr. Charles, is probably going to address this at some point. But I think on some level, we've drifted a bit afar from the fundamental purpose of policing and why it is that we want people to become police officers. What is that fundamental purpose? Why are we on this planet as cops? And we need to answer that because I think things flow from that. And we get caught up in things like policy is going to change things and Supreme Court cases are going to change the incidents of officer-involved shootings. And they certainly will help reduce them. And I'm not saying they're not valuable. But the fundamental pieces of this phenomena we're missing, I think. And until we start addressing those and fundamentally change those, realize quantum leaps in our difference in hiring, training, messaging to cops, I think we're going to just work around the margins and continue to see police shootings.
Ginger, so this is what I want to ask you, given what Jim just said. He acknowledges this higher sensitivity and the incidents that have occurred in other places in the country. But isn't that where training is supposed to meet perception? And training should make that perception of the threat more realistic. What kind of insight can you give us on that?
I think that there's a couple issues, and I really appreciate Jim's perspective on this, too. And I would say within my 27 years of policing, I can certainly point to changes in the training that I saw from the time that I began until I finished my career, and then the research that I've done since that time. And I would say that, you know, we really have created a systemic culture of fear within law enforcement, and I think Jim pointed out some excellent points in regards to why that happens. I also think that, you know, we're talking about human beings, and we have human beings that are in a culture of fear, and we have human beings that they're meeting out on the streets that are in a culture of fear, whether it's finances or will I be protected by my fellow officers or will I be shot today or whatever that is. You have the same concerns in the community, so you have these two communities clashing with each other. So as far as realistic, I think we actually need to get back to, you know, what is actually going on in the human being. We don't talk to police officers very often, if at all, about how is this going to affect you, how is it going to affect your family, what happens to your brain in these situations, because a lot of that is considered a soft tool rather than putting an AK-47 in an officer and saying, okay, this is what we need to do to defend our communities. And I'm using an extreme. But the importance is if you were going to talk realistic training, we're talking about systemic changes about how we're treating these people, because we're getting people who are traumatized, mm-hmm. stressed, and frightened into law enforcement right now. They're part of the community.
I really take seriously what you just said, Ginger, about touching back in with police officers in the wake of, you know, the many incidents that Jim and you have described. And you're saying there's not enough of that done.
No, I don't believe so. I think that, and I think Jim alluded to it as well. I think we're touching on the symptoms. We're not looking at the systemic issues that are underlying the entire police community or culture. And I would say, unfortunately for Minneapolis, this is an interesting example where now we have two situations in that community where there have been situations of quote unquote fear from
right.
the police officer.
Right.
And I did see the sign that was posted about our officers startle easily. Well, that's an interesting statement. So let's have a discussion. I would throw this out to the mayor. Let's have a discussion. You know, pay me expenses to come out there and let's brainstorm this and think about other creative ways to look at this rather than the typical systemic ways that we've been doing this for years that don't work. Let's think out of the box. Let's talk about what kinds of educations can we do for our command staff.
I want to let our listeners know, if you're trying to get in on the phone lines, very busy phone lines, call me back. You can reach me on Twitter at Kerri, KerriMPR. To the phones now, to TC in Minneapolis. And hi, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. What are you thinking about now?
Well, I just want to commend, first of all, Officer Jim, for just coming and giving his opinion, you know, about how he feels our officers are can be better trained. And I just, like, when I was calling to say that, like with the officers in both incidents, the partners, you know, I couldn't understand if the partner sitting there and seeing the officer pull his gun out and sitting on his lap and not say anything, you know. And like the officer was saying, Officer Jim, about how we're getting away, police officers are getting away from the basic understanding is to serve, you know, and protect. And I think a lot of callers, myself, I did not even know about the standard.
Mm-hmm. The you're talking about the court standard,
That Ms. Summer had brought up, the standard for police officers is protection over them. And I'm just wondering that if the conviction, if there was a conviction for the Philando Castillo case, if there was a conviction there, would Officer Moore would have thought twice about making the decision that he just did?
Okay, let me leave your question there, and I thank you for the call because we have a lot of other people that want to get in. To Tia in Minneapolis. Hi, Tina. Tia, sorry
Hi.
About that. Hi.
No, that's all right. Yeah, I just wanted to address kind of the most recent information about, you know, how reasonable it is and how the public may not understand that police officers are putting their lives on the line. And in response to that, just as a citizen of the city, I think that we all really do understand that. We understand that part of that job is always having your life in a somewhat dangerous position. But I think that it's unreasonable to ask the citizens to basically make the same choice. It isn't a choice for us. We just live there. And when in regards to our citizens of color, there's no way that they can shed their skin or make themselves look less aggressive just because a police officer is afraid. Something needs to change there. And in addressing the, you know, the Supreme Court protection of police officers, I feel like that historically it's quite evident that that's there to suppress the populations of the citizenry that that aren't as important and never have been. Okay. And I hope that this Justine case will change things, but it is a slap in the face to the Black community that it didn't happen earlier.
Jim, Tia, thank you. Jim, what do you hear in what she's saying?
Well, I don't disagree with her perception. I mean, there we have a bit of a dissonance between the common sense public expectation and reaction to officer-involved shootings, especially when the person that's shot by the police is not armed and in many people's view didn't pose any risk to them. And as your attorney guest earlier said, and the legal standard, the legal rules that apply to when officers shoot, and that's captured in the landmark decision of Graham versus Connor. This became such an issue, and I couldn't agree more with what the attorney said about how people don't understand this, to the point where we created an infographic that I would encourage all of your listeners to go to. You can just Google use of force infographic and it'll take you to it, or you can go to our website, which is policefoundation.org, and you can see what the standard is and the quote-unquote rules are for how police use of force should be done. But all of that aside, I think Tia expresses the frustration and frequently the outrage that many people have when they don't know much about what happened. Frequently, police departments, when there's a shooting, or do not release much information. I think this is part of the issue right now. And there's a reason for that. They're trying to balance the investigative process and maintain the integrity of that process with the need for the public to know. And when people do not know what happened in one of these kinds of cases, they will fill that information void with their own narrative based on their experiences with the police or their perceptions of the media reporting or other experiences. And when people expect that an officer is going to be prosecuted and or convicted based on shooting an unarmed person, and that doesn't happen, then it feeds the narrative that the system is rigged, that it's never going to prosecute cops for doing this kind of stuff. But it's because it's, you know, there's a different set of rules here going on, and this is why we've got to rethink. We have to seriously re-engineering how we think about police training. There are emerging technologies. We're experimenting with virtual reality, for instance, to try to give officers the opportunity to go through these experiences in as close to the real world as you can get without putting anybody at risk. And my own belief is that 10 or 15 years from now, this is going to be standard training for cops in how to deal with mass demonstrations or these kinds of things. We now have enough data and enough of these incidents where we literally could put every police officer in this country through this kind of training, low cost, done when they have time to do it because they work different shifts in different places, to give them the experience, the immersive feel of what it's like in one of these situations when you don't want to shoot somebody.
Boy,
these are
Jim, that is super
difficult situations.
That is really interesting, Jim, because, I mean, what you're almost talking about is what happens with pilots and those those simulators, right? What is it like in the immersive experience of being in a plane that's going down?
We're starting to see the same kind of technology being used in the medical field. So physicians can practice a procedure virtually before they work on the patient. And wouldn't we rather officers go through these critical situations before, in that virtual setting, before they hit the street? Now, just one footnote to this, though. Even with all of this training, police officers are required to make split-second decisions in the most challenging of circumstances with very little information and sometimes very little training. Until we understand that more thoroughly, we're going to continue to be frustrated by some of these incidents, no matter what kind of training, because police work is just not as, it's not like TV or the movies. It's not clean cut. It is very messy sometimes, and it's because we're dealing with the most complicated entity that we've ever known, and that's human beings.
By the way, if you've just gotten in on the show, Jim Bierman is with us. He's president of the Police Foundation and served as a police officer for many years. And Ginger Charles is executive director of the Institute for Spirituality and Policing and a professor at Saybrook University. Ginger, a call for you here from Paul in Minneapolis. Hi, Paul. What'd you want to say? Hey,
well,
Paul, go ahead.
Didn't want to get too far in the weeds with this. This is a very layered discussion. Mm-hmm. Very thankful you're having it, but I'm so frustrated with each one of these incidents, and I kind of hear the same from the, you know, the author side, or I hear the same kind of feedback was that they're stressed, they're undertrained, there are laws that we don't know about is the common. Pedestrian, there are rights that officers have that we're not knowledgeable about. It's a tough job, blah, 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 which I don't mean blah, blah. I get it. To me, it's probably the toughest job I can even imagine, although I'm not an officer.
Paul, can I ask you to, kind of zero in on your point?
We need oversight. Like, we need better oversight, culture-specific training, testing, better pay. Maybe we need monitors to monitor mobile vital sign monitoring to find out if an officer is too stressed to take that call or what have you. But Overall, what I feel like is that police are ours. We pay their salaries. Why do I feel like I am so disconnected to making any of these changes when they're mine?
Ginger, I think he's really getting at that question that I was asking listeners to think about. We're a community. We care about this. What can we do?
Well, I think that Paul brings up some great points. And when we look at the natural reaction of fear, normally we actually contract rather than expand. And so instead of opening ourselves up to finding out, what the problem is or how to relate to community, we will contract and withdraw. And so you see the disconnect between communities. And so that's the first start there. So, we know we have all these issues. We know that they've been around and that we know that they're getting uglier. And so I think it is really time that we have some kind of cultural shift within the law enforcement community. And I'm not saying that, who's to blame or what's going on here. I'm just saying that there are people not talking to each other. And it's interesting, even if you are for the police chief or against the police chief, that top cop is the one that controls the agency, and there is a belief that that person is responsible for that community, but it's really systemic. It involves all layers. It involves all communication within those layers too. So it's hidden in the culture, and that's what needs to be addressed. And it's not easy work, and it requires a lot more than just Jim and I on the call.
Yeah. A call here from Jim in Rochester about police training. Jim, what'd you want to ask?
I guess the essence of my comment just boils down to aptitude, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
More aptitude training on the front end so that some of these individuals aren't, frankly, making incorrect career choices. Say if you were going into the medical field and you want to be a surgeon, and the trainers start to notice that you're queasy, sticking your hands in guts and blood, they might steer you towards something less bloody and gory. I just think more stringent aptitude testing on the front end might be valuable.
Jim Bierman, what do you think of that?
Well, I don't disagree with the caller's sentiment, but I would encourage him or anybody else that has an interest in this, just kind of look a little bit at the vetting process that goes on for police officers now. The attrition rate is probably about 97-98% for all applicants that want to be police officers. There are a lot of people that want to be firefighters, so that part of public safety is taken care of. There are not a whole lot of people that want to be cops for a whole variety of reasons. And those that do want to, there are many people in that category that we don't want to be police officers. One of the problems, though, in the recruiting and hiring mechanisms and the systems that police departments use across the country is that we may be measuring the wrong things. I think this gets directly to the aptitude question that the caller was talking about, that we are very clear about certain aspects. Usually they're laid out in state regulations about what disqualifies somebody from being a police officer. But the area of emotional intelligence or the ability to be a better human being under stress, it may be areas that we just don't measure very well. There are limitations to testing processes and what we look at, and all of these go to, as Dr. Charles has said repeatedly, goes to the culture of policing and how much we really don't know about the culture of policing. The people who have been in the business understand a lot because they were there, but that culture may be unique to their department or to the state. One of the things everybody has to remember is that the United States has 50 different policing systems, at least,
wow,
based on the fact
wow
that there is no federal rule or regulations or legislation that regulates policing. So Minnesota has a series of laws that regulate policing, and California has them, and they're different.
Mm-hmm.
And policing is really good in this country in some places and not so good in other places. And even within the state, we have different levels of quality. So I think he's right. I think this issue, the question is, what are we going to measure? Are we getting to people's heart? Are we able to see inside them? And this is immensely difficult to do, but we should. This is part of that reengineering of policing, I think, that needs to take place.
Well, Jim and Ginger, thank you so much for the insight on this. I don't think we covered everything that everybody wants to talk about. We still have full phone lines, so I'm going to invite you both back for another conversation on this. Can we do that?
Sure. Certainly.
Great. Thank you. Jim Bierman with us, president of the Police Foundation, worked for the Redlands Police Department for 33 years and retired in 2011. Jim, thank you. And Ginger, always grateful for your time and your insight. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ginger Charles, executive director of the Institute for Spirituality and Policing and professor at Saybrook University. If you've missed some of the coverage, you can find it online at nprnews.org.